I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic.
Welcome back.
So I'm in this trap that I cannot spring, and I can't get out of it. I yearn obsessively for the effect of alcohol, and I can't obtain the effect. And when I seek it, all I get is a phenomenon of craving. I'm compelled by a physiological reaction to alcohol to burn my life to the ground every time I start drinking, and I have a mental obsession and a yearning inside me to go back to it, and I return to it like a moth to a flame, time and time again. And there seems to be no way to change that. And I think, I mean, when you think of it objectively, I mean, we are the market. If alcoholics and family members of alcoholics who are tortured by alcoholism would stop reading self-help books, the self-help industry would implode. I mean, we're the people who buy that stuff. The pharmaceutical companies would go out of business if we all got lit up spiritually and didn't need what they were selling. We are the people. We've tried everything. We're just those kind of people. I mean, we're so. I speak for myself. I'm so desperate and wrapped up in making me feel better and making me okay that I'll try anything that comes up. Anything that looks like it has, I get hope that this is going to make a difference, count me in. Sign me up. I'm there. I tried some crazy things. I primal screamed. Went to a primal therapist. I'm embarrassed to tell you, at one point, I was laying on the floor of the therapist's office, kicking my hands and feet and screaming at the top of my lungs, "Mommy, Daddy." It's hard for me even to tell you I did that. I was hypnotized. I did a lot of work with Gestalt therapists and transactional analysis, and I was in therapy with Albert Ellis, the founder of rational emotive therapy in New York City for quite some time. Dr. Silverman, who studied with Fritz Perls and Alan Watts. I mean, Silverman was an amazing, brilliant, top of the food chain kind of guy with therapy, but no human power. You know, isn't it odd that we seek to be different, we seek for relief, and momentarily, if you're like me, momentarily I would find things that would seem to create sort of an epiphany or a thing like, this is it. And then it would just wear off, and I'd always be back to being me again. And that's the bad news. I'm back to being me again. And the bottom of page 25. Talks about the dilemma. It says, if you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. Maybe you've had the same experience when you come to AA. They just seem like extreme fanatics, don't they? There's people in AA. I mean, they want you to, they talk about things like absolute abstinence. What do they mean by that? I mean, not everything. I need something. It's, you know, God's either everything or he's nothing. Why do you have to be like that? Can't you just kind of be in the middle somewhere? There is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. I'm just curious, how many people in this room, if you've never tried to kill yourself, at least have had those moments where you wished you were dead or you thought about it. Anybody? Right. Life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One, was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. I'm a funny kind of guy. I remember being in a treatment center and listening to a speaker in AA tell their story, and I was starting to identify. I was starting to feel like a connection. I'm sitting there and I'm kind of nodding my head. I'm thinking, wow, man, I might have drank with this guy. Yeah. He's cool. He's pretty good. Man, And then he talked about coming into AA and finding God. And the minute he said that, it was like this door closed. And I remember sitting there going, oh, what have they done to him? Oh, he's a freaking sunbeam for Jesus. Oh, my God. Oh, I felt sorry for him. I mean, it was like, and I'm dying, and he's a free man. And I'm feeling sorry for him, right? So it was hard for guys like me to accept spiritual help. I have a lot of prejudices about God from my childhood. And that's not uncommon. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is full of people that have been emotionally, sometimes physically abused by well-intentioned people under the flag of some religion. There may be people in this room that were sexually abused by members of the cloth. It's unfortunate. So what do we do? Is we throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I'm always like that. You know, when I get a resentment towards someone, it just, the next thing I know, I resent everybody in their family. Now, I've never met half their family, but if they're connected, they're related. I don't like you either. I resent their friends. I can have a best friend, and my best friend will say to me, oh, I really like so-and-so. No, I don't like him. You know what I mean? I won't like everybody in your religion. I won't like people that live. I can start hating your country, your race, your whatever. I resent by association. And so, I had a hard time with God, just accepting spiritual help with. And you know what's really going on? Is this tremendous fear that I have of God. Now, I'm not aware of it, but I have this tremendous fear, and I'm the kind of guy by nature that if I just suspect that you might not like me, I'm going to not like you first. Do you know what I mean? I bet you you've had. I'm sure I'm not the only one that's had that experience. Do you ever go? You're the new person at an AA group, and someone doesn't say hi to you, and you just, oh, one of those kind of people. You know, I mean, it just starts. It just, you know, and maybe they're having a bad day, and it's nothing to do with me, but I will build a case against them. And I did the same thing with God because some very well-intentioned people trying to, because I was a problem kid, trying to get and help me to straighten out, told me some things about God that just were horrific to me. They told me about a God who could see in the dark. Oh, that's bad. I do my best work in the dark. That's not good. I mean, he could see in the dark? Oh, God. Oh, my God. He could read my mind. Oh my God, he judged me for my thoughts. That's horrid. I got two movies, one's sex and one's violence. I mean, I drive down the road going, I'll kill him, I'll do her, I'll kill, you know, I mean, like I'm going to hell and I'm not doing nothing except thinking, you know, I'm just, oh. And I felt so stained. I felt so flawed. I remember I grew up a Catholic. I'll tell you a funny little story. We had this time of the year where the whole class would go to confession. Some of you, if you don't know what that is, talk to one of the Catholics. They'll tell you. You go and you're supposed to clean yourself, clean the slate so you can go the next day to receive communion. And if you really want to piss God off, go get communion with sin. I mean, it's a bad deal. So the whole class would go in. We'd go in these booths and we'd clean the slate. Now you got to go until the next morning without thinking nothing. I couldn't get out of the box and I'm thinking stuff. You know what I mean? And I'd go in that line with all those other little kids, and I just feel like a lightning bolt was going to hit me because I was receiving communion and I was stained. And I just started to know that I'm never going to measure up here. And it's a better proposition that there's not a God, because I feel so rejected. Now, I don't understand that I am the rejector and the rejectee. I'm imagining that God's rejecting me, so I'm rejecting him. But really, all the separation occurs within me, based on my prejudices and my fears. So accept spiritual help. No, I can't do it. So what's the other alternative? It says to go on to the bitter end. Blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And I tried that. I think I wanted to drink. I became, the last few years, I drank for oblivion. I drank to just blot me out. I wanted to drink myself to death. But it's a long and tedious process. And it's very brutal. And it takes so long that some of us, we start thinking about killing ourselves because we can't hang. Drinking yourself to death is like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on. And by the time it finally does kill you, you've wished you were dead for a long time. By the time it finally kills you, all the people that you love so much and you wanted their approval so much hate you. I know people. I run into a kid on the street. He's not a kid anymore. He's about 38 years old, I guess. And his dad and I were in detox together in 1978. His father, all his dad could talk about was his son. He loved his son. But over the next couple of years, he never stayed sober. And then the violence and the pathetic stuff. And he eventually drank himself to death. 30-some years later, you mention to the kid the dad's name, and he'll go off on a rant about that asshole. I hate him. 30 years later, he still hates his father. His father loved him. But that's what alcoholism does to us. You know, it's a brutal disease. Because it strips... The worst thing about alcoholism is it's gradually strips away everything of value in your life, and then it lets you linger on in the sameness of it day after day for a while. I heard this story many years ago, and it was a great description of the progressive nature of alcoholism. This friend of mine was talking about one of his best friends had been diagnosed as terminally ill with stomach cancer. And everybody was very sad. And I know what that's like. My mother was diagnosed as terminally ill. And the doctors pretty much are just saying to you, look, there's nothing we can do. Put your house in order. And about 3 months later, my buddy hears that they're going to have surgery on his friend. And he got excited. He thought, oh, my God, they're going to do surgery. They're going to cut the cancer out. He got very hopeful. Finally, they found a surgeon who knows what he's doing. And he calls over there, and the guy's mom answers the phone. He says, hey, I hear that they're going to do surgery and take the cancer out. And this guy's mom says, well, you know, not actually. They're going to do the surgery, but they're not going to take the cancer out. And he says, what do you mean they're going to do surgery and not take the cancer out? And he says, what are they doing the surgery for? He said, well, they're going to cut out sections of his stomach and intestines and pieces of his liver and internal organs to make room for the growth of the tumor so his last days on earth are not excruciatingly painful. And alcoholism is very much like that. If you're parents get in the way of the progression of the disease. This disease will cut them out of your life. If your career gets in the way of alcoholism, alcoholism will cut your career out of your life. If your self-respect or self-esteem or principles or morals get in the way, alcoholism will cut them out of your life. How many of us cross those lines at one time we said I'd never do that? And then you look back and you've done it a few times. Even your children, who you may love more than anything in the world, in time, alcoholism will cut them out of your life. I've seen countless men and women who have lost their rights to even see their kids through the courts. They've been taken away from them, and they live in the shame of that and the remorse. And I've also seen those same men and women, if they're willing to roll up their sleeves and do all the work, they get their kids back and they have sweet relationships with them as a result of step 8 and 9. Alcoholism will take away from the alcoholic more than any human being should ever, ever have to lose. And Alcoholics Anonymous will give you more than any human being ever has a right to have. It's almost the mirror image of the debacle. It's a beautiful thing. But some of us choose to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we can. And some of us do it and we're sober. What do you do if you draw? What happens to guys like me if I am absolutely convinced that I can't drink and I draw a hard line in the sand and I reinforce it by going to an AA meeting every day? I am not going to drink. Well, I will be forced to try other means to blot out my intolerable situation as best I can. Maybe sex, maybe pornography, maybe shopping, maybe gambling, maybe eating, maybe medications. But I will have to do something to blot out my intolerable situation. Because alcoholism demands treatment. That's the problem. It demands it. And I'm going to treat it one way or the other. It is an itch I must scratch, one way or the other. And why would we choose all these, this bitter, I know people who have stayed physically sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for decades and refused to buy the whole package here because of belligerent denial or ego or various reasons. And they are bitter, bitter people. They're angry, bitter people who battle with depression. Some of them eventually are forced into drinking again or committing suicide or getting on medication because alcoholism demands treatment. One of the guys I sponsored today, he's got almost 35 years, and he's a delight to sponsor. His name is Jer, and Jer loves me to tell this story. I met Jerry when he was 23 years sober. When he was 23 years sober with the benefit of step none, he has made the decision that he's tired. He's going to kill himself. He's totally alone. Nobody in his family will now have anything to do with him. He's built cases against every one of them, and he's right and they're wrong. You know how that is, right? There's nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous that he has a friend. He has no friends. He's got a pension that supports him because he'd been a Navy chief who was in the U.S. Navy, and he has money coming in for that. Because he couldn't hold a job. If he didn't have that, he'd been homeless because he's too angry to hold a job. He can't get along with people because he's right about everything. And he's been that way so long now, he can't take it anymore. And he's made the decision to kill himself. Well, when he made the decision to commit suicide, he got a little relief. And then right behind the relief, the obsession to drink returned. because he figured if I'm going to die, I should have a little anesthetic right before I cross over. You know what I mean? I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, if I'm going to kill myself, it might hurt something. I might, you know, I need a little anesthetic. It makes perfect sense. Well, the idea of him drinking is horrid to him because he doesn't mind that he's going to be dead. He just doesn't want everybody in AA to realize he no longer had 23 years. You know, so even the ego sometimes can be used by God to help us. So it pushed him into coming and asking me to sponsor him. And I said, I'd be glad to work with you. And I got to watch a man that was dying of this disease. I got to watch the lights come on with him. I got to watch him push himself aside and all the people he thought were wrong and he was right, to push that all aside and watch him go make amends to all those people. And I watched people start to love him again. I watched the restoration. He is a member of, he's almost 35 years sober, over 34 years sober now, and he's a member of my home group. When he was 23 years sober, nobody in AA would have anything to do with him. They were tired of him. They call him Sweet Jerry. You got to stand in line to hug this guy. I mean, he's like, everybody loves Jerry. How did that happen? Alcoholics Anonymous changed him. And he was going on, and he was bitter, and he was going to the end. I know why some of us commit suicide sober, because we can't wait till the end anymore. We're too bitter. So we accelerate it. We push ourselves to the end. So I have this, I am in this trap I can't spring. There is no way to change the phenomenon of craving. I've watched a man that had had 45 years sober drink. He went back to drinking, and that phenomenon of craving just waited for him. You can't be sober long enough to overcome that. You can't be emotionally well enough, spiritually well enough. It is in your cells. So the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous can offer a guy like me is to change my spiritual nature, my very being, so alcohol is no longer on the radar for me. It no longer has the hook. So that I can easily, as it says in our 10-step promises, just automatically recoil from it as from a hot flame. When somebody, there's a transformation that must occur in my very being that will take a guy like me, that if you offer me a drink and I'm able to use enough willpower to refuse it, I'll refuse it still with the yearning, like, oh my God, I'd sure like to have had that. And then years later, after the steps, walking into a suite on a cruise ship, and there's a complimentary bottle of $100 champagne there, and I pick it up as if it was cat urine and carried it to the guy who works there and said, would you find somebody that might like this? And there's no hook. There's no power in that. Come on. There's no power. Because the power in the alcohol is tied to the need for the medicine. Need for relief. But if you already got the relief, if your spirit is already okay, then there's nothing there. And I've had the experience of being sober many, many years and doing some things that were compromising my spirit, and all of a sudden bottles started talking to me again. It happens. So what's the problem? On page 45, it says something that's very interesting. It says, lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find that power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. The power to live. It's much, much more than the power to resist a drink. As a matter of fact, we don't even get that, really. I think that that's what I thought AA was going to give me. It was going to make me strong enough that I could resist temptation. But it's not that at all. There is no temptation. The problem has been removed. It's a major transformation in here. And when I was new, this is after relapsing time and time and time again, and I fought the bottle with everything in me. There were times when I meant it, when I said to myself, I'm never touching that again. And I heard this speaker when I was new, and he said, you know, I quit drinking seriously over 50 times. He said, every time I quit drinking, I got drunker in hell. He said, I think that quitting drinking was killing me. And I almost fell out of my chair. I thought, that's exactly right. If I quit drinking, I really quit drinking. And every time I quit drinking, it's almost as if it's the willful resistance of alcohol gives it torque. It gives it power and more energy. And some of the worst drunks I've ever been on have been after months and months of suppressed, willful abstinence. I'm not going to drink. And it's like a slingshot. I'm not going to drink. And by the time you eventually run out of power, you've got so much torque on that sucker. I went on to go on the worst drunk I ever went on and, you know, end up somewhere just despicable. So willpower really, it doesn't work. Something has to happen to us. Something has to happen. Something has to happen to you that will make the 10th step promises come true. That you could have alcohol in your home, and it would mean no more to you than the furniture. That you could work around it every day, and it wouldn't call to you at all. I worked around alcohol for 25 years of my sobriety. I had alcohol in my home for on and off for 20 years, I suppose, in some form or other. Sometimes just different. Sounds bizarre, but I had, for investment, I created a wine cellar, and I actually made a lot of money buying wines and holding them for 3 years and selling them. I had a wine cellar in my house, which I would forget was there. I have a meeting every Tuesday night in my house. In the living room, and newcomers knew it was there. They knew it was there. They could see it through the wall. In the room where the meeting was, up until I sold it, I had a collection of these 75 and 100-year-old cognacs. There was 8 bottles in the set. They were all hand-painted by the artist Erte. And I bought them many years ago for investment, and I just recently sold them this last year. And I never knew they were there. I forgot. They were in a display case, I have a whole bunch of artwork and knickknacks and stuff in my house. It's just there. It's just stuff. I forget they're there. New guys would come into the meeting and go, boing. You'd hear them, they'd go, I mean, because it has power to them. But see, it doesn't have power to us. And in that meeting, there's a ton of people sober over 20 years. This guy, I have meetings, people come to that meeting that are sober. We have guys over 50 years sober come there. And they don't even know, it's there either. It's right there out in the open, but they don't even see it. They see it any more than they see the vases and the other knickknacks and stuff. It doesn't mean anything to them. That has to happen. Otherwise, what are we going to do? Are we going to hide ourselves away somewhere where there's no temptation? It's kind of pointless, isn't it? We live in a world full of alcohol. The problem is not alcohol. The problem is the alcoholism. If I treat the alcoholism, the alcohol is not a problem. If I don't treat the alcoholism, I got a problem. So lack of power, the power to live. And it's more than that, because I don't know how sober, I don't know how to free myself. I get sober, I get stuck up in me and my emotions. I get locked up in here, and I don't have the power to come out and play. You ever been at a social event sober and you get that loneliness that comes over you, man? You're sitting in the corner and it's all of them, and then there's you. And you can't will yourself to fit. Something has to happen to me so I can come out and play with these people. And I can't manufacture that. Lack of power really is my dilemma. I'm a depressive alcoholic. I've been diagnosed as clinically depressed. I don't have the power to free myself from depression. I don't have the power to disconnect myself from this insanity, this mind that waits for me. I wake up in the morning afraid. I wake up in the morning having conversations with people I will see later that day. I drive in my car having conversations with people that aren't in the car. I don't have the power to free myself of the fear. I don't have the power to overcome the loneliness or the power to change my interaction with people so I can have relationships and intimacies like I see others have so easily. On page 52, it really talks about what it's like to get sober without power. What it's like to have, basically what I've come to believe is think of as untreated alcoholism. Right square in the middle of the page, in the third line in the middle paragraph, it says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. Now, that's probably not the case in Adelaide, but in where I come from, it's a big deal. If you go to a discussion meeting and half the time the problem is some relationship with somebody. I couldn't control my emotional nature. I'm a nutcase. I'm on this emotional roller coaster. I'm a prey to misery and depression. Depression is symptomatic of not drinking and not working the steps. It says it time and time again in our literature. Bill Wilson was the greatest example. We couldn't make a living. What is it about guys like me? I can work hard, work like hell. My boss will pat me on the back and say, you're a hard worker. And then eventually, I'm the guy they're letting go. They say things to me like, you're a hard worker, but you're not a team player. What does that mean? You know what it means. They never did like you, did they? And I don't even see it. I don't know what I'm doing here. Why I don't fit. Why they don't like me. Had a feeling of uselessness all my life. Like, what's life about? What's the meaning of all this? What am I going to be when I grow up, if I ever grow up? What's it all about? Useless. We were full of fear. We were unhappy, and we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. That's a pretty good description of me when I get sober. Now, I may hide it and keep it in the shade to best of my ability, but that's me. I ain't right when I quit drinking. And something's got to change. So lack of power, the power to live. So the promise here is that this book has a process in it that when I implement the process, I will acquire power. And here's a point. This is a point where we lose a lot of people in AA because they misinterpret what they hear in the meetings. You know, if you go to a bunch of meetings, you eventually start hearing this message that God changed these people's lives. You go, okay. And what some of us at that point, we eventually surrender to the God idea. And we think we've arrived somewhere. That's the beginning of the road. That's not the end of the road. That's the beginning of the road. Step two is the beginning of the road. It's not the end of the road. And we lose people at this point because they never go through the rest of the steps. They think, okay, I get me and God now, we're good. We're good. And they'll often go join a church or something. Which, there's nothing wrong with church. There's nothing wrong with going to the gym. There's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. But none of it has ever been a substitute for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a good addition, but it's not a substitute. I've had because the problem is not lack of religion. It's not even lack of faith. It looks like it, doesn't it? You go to meetings, you think the problem is I don't have faith. I don't believe. It's not that. There have been men and women with tremendous faith in God drinking themselves to death over the years. Tremendous. I had the occasion to sponsor over the years at four different occasions, four different members of the cloth, clergy. Two of them drank themselves to death. I remember I wasn't sober that long, and there was this priest, Frank. He was a good guy. He's not a deviant priest. He's a good guy. But he had alcoholism, and he had a bad case of alcoholism. And I was one of a bunch of guys that tried to work with Frank. And he called me up one day, and he was drinking again, and he was full of self-pity. He's sobbing uncontrollably into the phone because he felt so lost and so decrepit. And he can't understand why here he is, a man of the cloth who's devoted his whole life to his church and to God, a man who prays more in one day than most AA members will pray in a week, who reads more spiritual literature in one day than most of us will pray in a week, why he would ask God to keep him sober, and he's drinking again. And in AA, there's drug dealers and prostitutes and robbers, and I mean the dregs of the earth. God's keeping them sober, and he must have felt like cheated or something. Like, what's wrong with me? I mean, I'm a priest, for God's sakes. I should have, you know. And I thought the same thing. I thought, oh my God, I'm sober through God's grace. I knew that, and if that's true, I would think that this priest, would have a leg up on a bum like me. But lack of faith was not his problem. It was lack of power. I live in the desert in Las Vegas, and if you were to come and visit me in this time of year, which is the peak of our summer, there are days when it'll get 115 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that translates out into centigrade, but I think it's something like, oh my God, it's hot. I mean, it's really hot. And on one of those days, I could take you in my car, drive you 45 minutes outside of town to one of the largest lakes and bodies of fresh water in the western United States, Lake Mead. It's a huge lake. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of shoreline. And take you to that lake, drive you up right up to the edge of the lake, let you get out of the car, jump in the lake, swim in the lake, drink the water until you have absolute faith that water exists. Put you back in my car, drive you out into the middle of the desert, give you a 9-step set of directions on how to get back to that lake, and let you out in the middle of that desert. If you don't follow the directions on how to get back to that water, you will die of thirst in the desert with absolute faith that the water exists, if you don't find a way to get to the water. You will die of thirst in the desert just as painfully and brutally as the man who never even believed that the lake existed or never saw the lake. And that's the problem. There have been alcoholics for thousands of years with faith in God, dying, knowing that God's the answer, but they can't actualize it in their own life. I know I'm not the only one that's ever ended up in a jail cell in a moment of just horrid desperation, begged to God that I'm not even sure exists, with tears in my eyes, not to let me drink again, and I drank the day I got out. I bet you there's people in this room that have begged God not to let them drink again and drank again. There's probably people in this room that have been saved or born again and then drank again. Because the problem is not lack of faith, it's lack of power. I have to actualize and make a connection with God. We talk about something in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't know that it's unique, but it sometimes it appears what we're talking about is different than what I hear out there a lot. We talk about this thing called conscious contact. And there's a very big difference between conscious contact and faith. All of you that drove here today, when you leave, you will get in your cars and you will go out on the road and you'll go out there with faith that there are traffic laws and there are police to enforce them. And possibly that faith will inhibit your driving patterns and you'll drive accordingly to what you believe. That's a good thing. You get a cop in your rearview mirror with his lights flashing, you've got conscious contact. And one is experiential in the now, right here, and the other is just of the mind. The problem with faith of just in the mind, in moments of severe turmoil, it's elusive. I must seek at best intermittent conscious contact. And the reason I say it's intermittent is I've never known anyone who legitimately can make a conscious contact with God and hold it. It seems to come and go like the waves on the shore. There are days when I've just walked out of a fifth step, listened to some guy's fifth step, or I just came off a 12-step call, or I just walked out of the detox meeting where I am, man, I'm plugged in. I feel the presence of God. I am very hooked in. I mean, I should have a tent and a tambourine. I am plugged in. And then there are other days where I'm on my knees in the morning. I'm just, I don't believe and feel like there's anything. I'm praying anyway, just hoping it's going to turn around and the wave will come back in again. And, you know, I think the important thing is the actions that I take, regardless of how I feel. Regardless, because if you take the first couple letters off the word spiritual, you end up with the word ritual. And I take the actions of someone who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous on the days I feel plugged in, and I take them on the days of desolation, when I feel alone and I have no contact with God. And what happens is it cycles. Some days I feel very connected, and other days all I feel is me. And it always cycles. And the important thing is to stay centered in the solution. There's a thing that started about 25 years, 30 years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a type of meeting called, they're problem-solving meetings, which for a fellowship based on the principle that we can't manage our own life is a little bizarre to me, but what do I know? And these meetings, they always start out with, does anybody have a problem? And there'll be some new person who does not want to be sponsored, who wants to use all of Alcoholics Anonymous for feedback so they can remain at the helm of their ship and choose what they want to do from what they hear in the meeting. They want to remain self-directed. They'll throw a problem out on the table until they hear what they want to hear, right? And as if you could get advice from the meeting. Well, if you've ever tried that, it's horrible. You can't get it. Trying to get advice from an AA group is like trying to take a drink of water from a fire hose. I mean, it's just over. Because everybody in the meeting will start sharing at you. I mean, and what happens about halfway through the meeting, you can't sit anymore. You're getting advice is coming at you like missiles, man. Stop it. You'll bolt out of the meeting, leave the meeting spinning on your problem. no human power. See, the solution is never found within the problem. No matter how obsessively you stare at your problems, you will not find the solution there. The solution is independent of the problem. And what is it about us? I think that if I stare obsessively enough or worry enough obsessively about a problem that I'll find the answer. That's never been true for me. The answer usually comes out of left field. My grand sponsor used to say there's one problem and it includes and encompasses all problems. And there's one solution and it encompasses all solutions. And what is the problem? It's conscious or unconscious separation from God and God's kids. It's the aloneness of alcoholism. And what is the solution? The solution is to make the connection, is to clear away the things in me that stand between me and God and me and you. See, I always had too much of me between me and you. That's why alcoholism is such a lonely business. It's a very lonely business. And I have too much of me between me and God. And so I must seek this power, and I will seek it through self-reduction. And the first bit of self-reduction that the book asked me to do is on the following page. And it's a very simple little exercise, and yet it's not easy. In the middle of page 46, it talks about two things. That if I can do these two things, I've done step two. Not only have I done step two, I'm on the road to get results, to have transformation in my life. The first thing it says in the middle paragraph, the third line down, it says, first, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice. Well, that sounds simple enough, except that most of our prejudices exist within us on an unconscious level. I don't think they're prejudice. That's not a prejudice. That's really the way it is. I feel this stuff. It exists within me on an emotional, unconscious level. It's a sense. It's a positioning towards life. Father Martin used to say that when emotion and intellect are in conflict with each other, emotion always wins because it's persistent and it wears you down. So I have these prejudices that exist within me sometimes as they're very old ideas, so old I can't even bring them up sometimes, and yet they affect me. I'll tell you a couple of them. Now, some of them might come from events that have occurred in your childhood. Maybe where some priest beat you up and you just threw out everything. But it might just be like what's so common in so many of us. There seems to be, I won't say it's universal, but it's so common that it's almost, is this prejudice or this old idea that drives guys like me, and yet I'm not conscious of it. And what it is that on my worst day, sober, I'm sober and I should know better, when you did the thing that you're really, really ashamed of, the thing that you just kind of loathe yourself for, and you didn't mean it, but you did it, and it's horrible, and it haunts you. And I don't know what that thing was. Maybe you had sex with, you're in a marriage or a relationship, and you cheated on the person, or maybe in a moment of just tremendous fear and anxiety, maybe you struck out at your kids and they didn't deserve it. And you remember the look on their face. And you just scared them to death. Or maybe you mistreated your dog. Or maybe you did something at work involving money and you were so afraid of when they confronted you that you let someone else take the blame. Maybe you had sex with someone you don't even want anybody to know you have lunch with. But at those moments when you hate yourself, the feeling or the sense that now God can't possibly be there for me. I'm too flawed. I'm too stained. That is an old prejudice that so many of us have in common. And the problem with the prejudice is it occurs within us. It doesn't come from God. God loves me no matter what. The problem with that prejudice is that when I'm in trouble and the moments I need to turn to God the most because of the prejudice, I turn away from God because I can't go there. It's too good. It's look at me. It's a horrid prejudice. I've been over to Florence, Italy a couple times. Scott's going over there in a couple weeks. And someone else here is going. If you ever go over there, there's a museum right behind the Duomo in the center of town called the Opry. It's a smaller museum. It's not one of the ones that are more touted like usually the one where the David is. This is a smaller little deal. I went in there to find a statue that a friend of mine told me about. And it's a statue by the Renaissance sculptor Donatello. And it's called the Magdalena. And it's a statue of Mary Magdalene. And I got into the museum and I'm searching almost frantically for this statue I'd heard so much about. I really wanted to see it. And I walked into this room on one of the upper levels and I turned my head and it was there. And the moment I saw it, I knew it was what I was looking for. And it was life size. And it was a depiction of Mary Magdalene unlike anything I've ever seen. This was not a depiction of Mary Magdalene as a beautiful woman with long flowing red hair and a robe. And this was a woman who was clothed in dirty, tattered, and torn rags. A woman who had evidence of much physical beatings. A woman who had signs of malnutrition. A woman who walked with a countenance of shame. A woman who apparently has been turning nickel and dime tricks on the back alleys of the Middle East for years. And in her shame and remorse and self-loathing, she stood there and her head was cocked to the side. And in the midst of this demeanor of shame and remorse, there was an inquisitiveness and a look of disbelief. And she held her hands like this, as if she wanted to pray, but she was afraid to, as if she didn't deserve to. And she was looking up, and I looked across at what she was looking at, and there was a crucifix on the other wall, and she was looking up into the sky, as if she was saying, this could be for me? And I just stood there and I started weeping. And I started crying because I was looking into my soul. I was looking into the unworthiness and the disbelief and the fear of rejection if I ever turned to God. He can't possibly help someone like me. Not after all the things I've done. Not after all the people I've hurt that loved me. And I think that is a prejudice that we all come here with. It is one of the great old ideas that I am delighted to have been proven wrong. As a matter of fact, over the years, I've developed a new idea that based on my experience, just on what has actually happened to me and happened to the guys I sponsor, that I think God loves us the most at the times when we're the most decrepit. I imagine sometimes that there have been times, drunk and sober, when I've done things that the God that loves me as much as he loved me must have wept that I would do that to myself or I would do that to one of his kids. That I think he loves me the most then. Because maybe that's when I need it the most. I didn't come here, I came here an atheist. What I really was a guy with a lot of resentments towards the religion of my childhood and a lot of fear. And the book says, can you lay aside your prejudice? It doesn't say I have to get rid of them. The priest that drank himself to death couldn't lay aside his judgments and his ideas and his opinions because he thought they were the right kind. He thought he was entrenched in them. Now, they very well, some of them very well may have been of right. But the book's not asking you to throw them away. It says lay them aside and work the rest of this process and make a conscious contact. Have an awakening of your spirit. And then let's revisit them. And as you revisit them, you may find some of them were really good. Some of them were stupid. But revisit them awake, with your spirit awake and alive, to see if they're real. And then the second thing, if I can just do that, if I can become childlike, to lay aside all my old ideas, all my prejudices, all my opinions and judgments about God and the universe and everything, just become childlike as if I don't know anything. And then the second thing it says, and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than myself. The book promises me, if I can do those two things, I will commence to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. You don't have to understand God. You don't have to comprehend God. I know why you'd like to. Same reason I'd like to. It's the same reason I want to figure my boss out. Because if I can figure him out, I'll have some angles. You know what I mean? I understand knowledge. You think knowledge is power. If I can comprehend God, maybe I can get a little bigger piece of the pie here. You know, I understand that. The book says, don't try. Just do. Don't think. Do. Express. Express a willingness. Now, this is talking about actions. Express a willingness. Start acting as if. We're asking you to enter into what a scientist might call a working hypothesis. We're presenting you with an idea, and if you're like me, you don't believe in God. I'm afraid of God. I'm not willing to chance the rejection, because if this is the last house on the block and I go try to knock on that door and I'm thrown cast aside, I don't know where to go, so I ain't going here. And you're telling me you don't believe in God. It's perfectly all right. But we want you to start acting as if this power exists. They said, we want you to physically get down on your knees every morning and ask whatever this thing is that's running the universe for help. And I remember saying to the guy, well, I did it this morning, but I don't think I should do it. I don't really believe in God. I feel like a hypocrite. He says, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it. And I just started getting on my knees. And they start every time something else comes up, ask God for help. Felt stupid to me. Started doing it. And from the moment I started to turn my consciousness towards something I don't even believe in, I started to get results. It was amazing. Coincidences, little coincidences. I bet you there's people in this room are having these experiences to this day, where you'll be all jacked up about something. You don't even understand what's going on. You just feel horrible. You feel like you're going to have a nervous breakdown and you don't know what to do. And you go to some meeting and there's a stranger there talking about exactly what's going on with you in a way that you can hear it and see it through his eyes. And now you get it and you know what to do. Who had that guy talk about that at that moment when you were needed in that meeting? My home group had a phone list, and I would be sitting in my apartment, and I'm a depressive. I'm one of those kind of guys, I shouldn't be, in early sobriety, prior to working the steps, you shouldn't leave me unattended for very long. I'm not good. I just think, you leave me alone for 5 minutes, I think, and I don't, when I ponder myself, I don't spiral upward. I spiral downward. I'd be sinking into a depression. And the phone would ring. There'd be some guy in my home group who doesn't know me that well. I'm not his sponsor. Who can't get a hold of his sponsor. Needed to talk to somebody. And called me at the moment when I needed to be pulled out of myself. Who had him call? Who had him call at that moment? And I started to understand and realize after time and time and incident after incident, there was something working here. Now, this is not the end game. This is just the beginning of rudimentary faith. I must move further into conscious contact through the rest of the steps, but it's a beginning. I was over, I think this is the way most of us come to believe. I'm a stubborn kind of guy. I can't believe in God because you tell me to. I wish I was wired that way. I would have saved myself years of grief, but I am not. I am a skeptic. You got to prove it to me. And God did. One of my favorite lines, it's very touching to me in the book. It says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. From the moment I just even turned my attention a little bit in his direction, he came the rest of the way. I mean, he did 90% of it. I just did a little tiny thing here. And he started to prove himself to me time and time and time again. Many years ago, I go over to England about once a year to do some stuff like this. I sponsor some guys in London, and I enjoy going over there. It's not in the winter so much, but in the summer. And the first time I ever went over there, I was walking around Westminster, down around Hyde Park and Buckingham Palace. And the streets down there in Westminster all have gas streetlights. And I noticed something as I walked through Hyde Park, that some of the poles where the gas light was in the top had these little boxes on the side of the poles, and they'd been welded shut and they'd painted over. But at one time you could see that that had been like a door that would open on the side of the pole. And what it had been many years ago, before they had the technology of the electric starters and the computerized thing that turns the gas on, is that there was a little door there, and a man would come along at twilight, and he'd open that little door, and he'd reach in with a key, and he'd turn the gas on. And then he'd reach up with a flame on the end of this long pole, and he'd light the street light. And at twilight, when the guys are going through the streets lighting the street lights, you could climb up to the roof of the highest building in London, look out of the city, and you won't see where the guy is, but you'll see where he'd been. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of these actions, and I couldn't see where God was, but I could see where he'd been. I mean, the coincidences were mounting up. And those of us, if you're fortunate enough to be sponsoring people and doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous, then that is an up-close and personal view of the hand of God, because you'll sponsor guys and you'll see it so clearly in him, where it's harder to see it in yourself. You know, the reason I think that it's hard to see the hand of God in our own lives is because God works very slowly. I mean, he's old. I mean, he's very old. Now, like, trying to watch the hand of God in your life is like trying to stand in front of the mirror and watch your hair grow. I mean, it's not that it's not growing. It's just so slow. But in other people, you'll see him, and you see him a week later, and oh my God, you notice the difference. He was shaking, couldn't hold a cup of coffee last week. He had the dead eyes, and look at his eyes now. Is that him laughing with those guys? Is that him with people he sponsors? Oh my God, he got his kids back. And you start to see it. It's miraculous what we see here. And how else are you going to come to believe except like that? I heard my sponsor tell a story 30 some years ago, back in 1980. And I've never heard it put better. Why we take these actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, these actions that we don't believe in. and we do them and it changes our lives. He said that when you hit a bottom with drinking, it's very much like being shipwrecked at sea. And there you are, out in the middle of the ocean, hundreds if not thousands of miles from land, and you're all alone and you're in a bad spot and you're treading water and you're getting tired. And when you're getting to the point where you're starting to wonder if you can even go on anymore, here come these two goofy-looking idiots in an invisible boat. And they're pretending like they're on top of the water rowing across. And they are on top of the water. You don't know how they're there. And they're just rowing up to you. And they say, my name's Bill. My name's Bob. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We have God and these wonderful 12 steps that will solve all your problems. And you look at them and you go, you got nothing. Get away from me. You guys are wacko. Get out. And they row off. And about that time when you can't stay up anymore, over the horizon comes this big chrome ocean liner. It says treatment center on the side. And they got therapists and doctors and nurses and vocational rehabilitation specialists and members of the opposite sex and medications and guys with doctorate degrees. And you know, you suspect that a person of your depth and complexity must surely need all of this. And you get on board, and it's amazing. I mean, you're getting in groups, and you're cracking the secrets of everything that's wrong with you, and you're getting all this information, this knowledge, and this is fantastic. 28 days later, over the side. And there you are, treading water as the ocean liner goes off to sea, and there you are, treading water, and you're getting tired, and you don't know if you can make it, and you start going under, and you're desperately trying to stay afloat and not drown. And when you're about ready to go down for the last time, here come those two assholes in that invisible boat. My name's Bill. My name's Bob. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We have God, and these beautiful 12 steps solve all your problems. And you go, oh, you got nothing here. But you're too weak to resist, and they pull you on board. And there you are. You're sitting on top of the water. You don't even know how you're sitting there. As some of us at 8 and 10 and 12 months sober, sitting in a meeting of AA, realizing you're sober longer than you've ever been sober since you first had a drink. And you don't know how this is happening to you. And you go, what do I do? And they go, oh, row. Row what? Just go like this. And a funny thing happens. The more you row that boat, the more substantial it becomes. And it starts to appear before your very eyes as a result of your rowing it. And maybe 10 years later, you get so comfortable in that boat, you stop rowing it, and it starts to disappear. Alcoholics Anonymous will always be an action program. And the sad part about that is it's an action program for people who don't like to do action. We're thinkers, basically. I just like to think. Don't you have a thinking man's program? That's why we don't have a chapter in the book. We have a chapter into action, not into thinking, or into pondering, or figuring, but into action. And if I can take these actions as a way of life, the power starts to materialize in my life. But there's more work to do, because this is not the end. On page 55, I'm going to touch on this and we'll break for lunch. These two paragraphs in the middle of the page are beautiful. They are a very precise description of where you're going to find the power, how you're going to find the power, and when you're going to find the power. I mean, this is telling you what's going to happen to you as a result of steps 4 through 9. It's remarkable. Now, this is coming right out of the section on all the prejudices and all the doubts and all our resistance to God. This is in the chapter We Agnostics, and it starts with the second paragraph that says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down within you, deep down within me is God. No, I don't think so. I used to hear the old timers say stuff like that. They'd say that they would listen to the still small voice of God within them. My grand sponsor was speaking at our inner group one time, and I got in the line to thank him. And a man, a couple people ahead of me in the line, asked Chuck a question. He said, "Where do you? How do you find God?" And Chuck pointed right in his chest, and he said, "He's not lost. He's right in there." How could something so good and so powerful be in something that I know to be so bad and so weak? There was a woman named Diantha. Diantha was very spiritual, and she'd worked these steps, and she was very cool. She had a tremendous relationship with God. She was a knitter. She would sit and knit, and it was sort of like some kind of meditation thing. She'd knit in the meetings, you know. And me and some idiot that I got sober with, we learned that if you said the F word in the meeting, she'd speed up her knitting a little bit. So we were determined to make sparks fly off her knitting needles, you know, because we're idiots. And one day in a meeting, and I always liked to listen, when she would share, I'd always listen to her because something was talking through her. And one day she talked about how much she just liked to sit alone with her and God and commune with God. And the way she said it, it sounded kind of cool. And I'd done meditation and stuff, and as a kid in the years I was drinking and doing drugs, and I thought, yeah, that's the deal. I'm going to go home and I'm going to be quiet, no TV, no stereo, and I'm just going to commune quietly with God. And I went home and I sat down to commune with God, and I discovered that when it gets quiet out here, it gets very noisy in here. And in about 30 seconds, I felt like I was having an anxiety attack, and I had to go turn the TV on because I can't be alone. Well, so what's that about? Is it that there's something wrong with me that's not wrong with these other people in AA that go inside themselves and connect with God? I go inside myself. I connect with a pack of crazy people. I don't find God. I find legion. I mean, I find like demons and stuff in me. What is it? Well, the next line in the book tells you exactly why you can't connect with God yet. You haven't worked this program of self-reduction. It says that it may be obscured. That means that the God is within me, but he's blocked from me. He's obscured by three things. The first thing is calamity. Bill talks in his story about worldly clamors. He makes the connection in town hospital with God, and then it's immediately pushed aside by worldly clamors. This chattering incessantly in my head. These nonstop conversations I have with myself and other people in between my ears. I mean, if God really was inside me, even if he had a megaphone, I don't know that I would hear him over the clamor inside me. It just talks to me all the time. It's just there. It just says stuff to me all the time, just negative stuff. You know, that headache is really a brain tumor, Bob. You know, it's just crazy stuff. Don't listen to them. He didn't say hi to you. He never did like you. He's talking crap about you, don't you know? You know, it just says it. Don't listen to your sponsor. He's old. He said don't date her, but what does he know? He's old. You know, it just says crap to me all the time. It never stops. It wants me to quit jobs. It wants me to tell people off. It just chatters to me all the time. A few years ago, I was talking to a woman who's very scholarly about spiritual. She reads a lot of spiritual stuff, everything from Buddhism to the Bible. And she's also a linguist. And she had read the Bible, the Old Testament, in the original language that it was written in. And she said, you'd be surprised if you read it. And he said, most churches have twisted it. She said, if you read it in the original language, it's very different. She said, in Genesis, in the part about the Garden of Eden, when you get to the part where it talks about the serpent, she said if you were to translate the original word literally into the English, it would not be the word for serpent. The word that they actually used was the word that described the sound that the serpent made. It was the hiss and the slither. You don't see it, but you can hear it in the tall grass. It just is chattering at you all the time. It never goes away. It's just there. And on a good spiritual hair day, what happens is exactly what it says in step 10. I am placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, not just from alcohol, but even from me. And at those moments, the hiss and the slither become distant, like music in a doctor's office. It's there, but you don't even hear it anymore, do you? Because it doesn't have your attention. And yet you get me spiritually sick. And it just smears itself across the windshield of my car, and I can hear and see nothing else. Because all of a sudden, life becomes, and my sponsor becomes, and the people in the meeting become music in the doctor's office. Because now this thing is right here. I'm in the bondage of it. Or it says in our third step, the bondage of self. So the first thing that obscures me is calamity. The second thing that obscures me is pomp. That I fill up with myself to the point where I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. You know, I'm the guy, become the I know everything guy. The guy that goes to meetings and only can hear what's wrong with you and can't hear what's right with you. I'm that guy again. I'm full of myself, like a glass of water filled to the top. There's no room for anything else. And then the last thing, and I'll talk about this and we'll break. Worship of other things. Isn't it odd that I have been a worshiper of other things all my life and never knew it? Because I didn't know what it meant. And I was about a little over a year sober, and I was ending my first sober relationship. Now, I got to tell you something. I sponsor a lot of guys who have problems with relationships. I don't think there is a human being on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. I mean, oh my God. You can go up to a guy like that and say, I just came from the doctor, I have terminal cancer, 2 weeks to live. And you'll go, you know what else she said? You know, I just... So I'm in the grip of that. And I'm dying here. I'm dying emotionally and spiritually. And I go to a meeting hoping to hear something that'll snap me out of it. And I can't hear nothing because I'm so sick and so into myself that what's going on in the meetings like music in the doctor's office. But I end up at a coffee shop with an old timer that was from out of town after the meeting. And I'm telling him, I had him hostage in this booth. And I start telling him about the relationship for about 30 minutes till his eyes have glazed over. And he, very polite man, listened to me. And then when I was done, he said some things that rocked me. He said, have you ever thought about the first commandment? The minute he said that, I bristled with a little bit of old prejudice. I said, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he laughed. He said, yeah, I know. He said, you and I are very much alike. He said, guys like us have a hard time with the thou shalt not, don't we? And I thought, yeah. He said the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. And by some well-meaning people, as they were translated, he says, I think it was the Greeks that put an authoritarian spin on them. He said, as it exists in the English today, it says, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. He said, you know that... I know that God loves me no matter what. I can put anything I want between me and God will still love me. He said, the problem is, when you put something between you and God, you block the light. He said, when you worship something, it doesn't mean to bow down to it. It simply means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He said, you want to know what you worship? make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about today, and the thing that would own the pie graph would be obviously the thing you keep obsessively turning your consciousness towards. When he said that, I pictured the pie graph with a little sliver for AA, a little sliver for work, and the rest of the pie was this relationship. And I knew why I was in such desolation, fear, and depression. I knew why it felt like someone had stepped on the oxygen hose to my very soul. Because I blocked the light. I put this relationship right here between me and life itself. And I was smothering myself with it. Cut off from you, cut off from God, and cut off from me. And so Alcoholics Anonymous, we're going to start getting after lunch, we're going to get into this process of reducing this stuff so that I can connect with God. Unobscuring myself so that this becomes a reality deep down within me. The book refers to it as the great reality, deep down within me. And the beauty of that is I will open a portal within myself to the hard drive of the universe that will inspire me and draw me to those things that will be good for me. If I can surrender the ego and the chattering and not follow this and follow this. And the steps is what connects me to that. We're going to break?